Welcome to the return of the Primal Endurance Podcast. This is your host, Brad Kearns, and we are going on a journey to a kinder, gentler, smarter, more fun, more effective way to train for ambitious endurance goals. Visit primalendurance.fit to join the community and enroll in our free video course.
The first objective before trying to drop excess body fat is to get healthy, because you simply will not succeed long term with dropping excess body fat until you get a healthy metabolism going.
I'm pleased to present BRAD Grass-Fed Whey Protein Isolate Superfuel, the absolute highest quality, all-natural protein supplement infused with creatine that delivers everything you need to optimize your appetite for fat loss, recover quickly from workouts, and build and maintain lean muscle mass, the single most important attribute for aging gracefully. Our protein comes directly from small family farms in America's dairy land of Wisconsin. It's cold processed and microfiltered for maximum bioavailability and digestibility. So please don't mess with the many cheap commodity protein supplements that are ineffective, inferior, less pure, and often contain junk sweeteners, especially the plant-based offerings that are vastly less bioavailable than the gold standard of protein supplements, that's whey protein isolate. Whether you're in your peak athletic years looking to grow and recover, or in the older age groups trying to delay aging and decline, whey and creatine are widely agreed to be the most critical and effective supplements to take for the rest of your life. You can easily stir the superfuel in water or make a delicious smoothie every day. I'm certain that you're going to love the pleasant, light, natural vanilla bean and cocoa bean flavors. So try some on Amazon today. It's a huge hit with dozens of five-star reviews. Or you can order direct from bradnutrition.com with our buy three, get one free, and make the super fuel a centerpiece of your daily routine. Hello, listeners, viewers. It has been a while, but it's time to get into some Q&A for the Primal Endurance Podcast. And I have enjoyed doing these shows over the years. Love getting bombarded with thoughtful questions, and especially success stories and comments, and just the sharing of the challenges that endurance athletes in particular face. And so, again, we have a nice treasure trove of interesting insights to discuss. And we're going to start with Alan. Alan says, "Hey, Brad, I'm a longtime follower of you, Mark, Phil Maffetone. You guys have left me puzzled with your micro workouts, or what Phil Maffetone calls slow weights." And what Phil means by that is going over, during the course of a day and doing one set of something and then carrying on. Same thing that I like to call micro workouts. I understand the concept. It's been implemented a long time ago because I'm a bus driver and I have to wait 20 minutes between runs there. So the bus is my gym, and I can do quite a few exercises with some creativity. Oh, I'd love to see that on a parked bus. You go in, look in the window, and the driver's doing an iron cross hanging onto the railings above each seat or something. But both of you, you guys never talk about warming up. And in your last episode, Brad, you said that you pass by your pull-up bar or you do a set of deadlifts as you're going through the side yard. Phil talks about picking up the weights in his kitchen. Now, if I deadlift or pull up as my first exercise, I might have a chance of getting injured. Usually, I do some kind of warm-up set, like elevated push-ups, before doing something more difficult. What are your thoughts on the matter? And greetings from the Dolomite Mountains in Italy. All right, so we got a bus driver in the Dolomites weighing in. I love the global connection here with the podcast. Thank you so much for writing in, Alan, and a very, very important topic. And I am humbled and appreciate the chance to comment here, because I realize over time that I've related my tremendous enthusiasm for micro workouts without sufficiently noting the importance of doing something that you're adaptable to when you take these brief interludes from prolonged periods of stillness. So if you are
unfit or moderately fit, it's not going to be a great idea to pick up a weighted deadlift bar and do one set, not even doing a pull-up bar, because the pull-ups are pretty strenuous. And I was just assuming that baseline level of fitness competency, where for me, I can get up after spending a couple hours in front of a screen and do a set of deadlifts with perfect form and minimal risk. But it's taken me a long time, and I've tweaked my back several times over the years because my deadlift form was a little suspect, and I did it without proper attention to technique. So when we're doing especially something brief and explosive coming from a period of inactivity, you want to get the blood flowing. And depending on your fitness level and depending on what you're trying to do, this might mean 30 seconds of just some general movement, shaking out the legs. And it might mean something more significant if you intend to do, for example, a set with a weighted bar. So I always use the example of, hey, just rush up a staircase as a micro workout. So if you are coming from minimal fitness competency or a history of injuries or a long period of sitting, what you might want to do on the staircase is ascend it regularly the first time and then go back down and pick up the pace a little bit on the second one, go back down and do four or five sets where maybe the fifth one, you're doing something that more resembles a sprint, where I'm boasting that I do every single time I ascend a staircase in the home as my rule. So yeah, definitely scale the micro workout effort to your level of competency. But I also use a frequent example of just standing up at your desk, at your cubicle, even with little or no room to work with, and you can perform a set of 20 deep squats as a wonderful micro workout. And that one is pretty minimal risk. Even if you've been sitting for a long time, I'd say stand up, shake out the legs, and do a few squats in a really slow speed. And then if you start to feel warmed up and comfortable and you have good form, you can speed up your pace as you get through the set. So thanks for pointing that out, and always a good time to recommend and remember the importance of micro workouts. Here comes Charles. I know you get a bunch of messages from folks, and I want to tell you that my son won the 3,200 meters North Carolina Championships as a sophomore. 3,200 meters, known as the 2 mile, also in track and field. So the state champ in sophomore, pretty awesome. And Charles says he won it because of advice you gave on your podcast. All right. Congratulations to your son. My son was the only person on his team who was not overtrained. He's projected to win cross country for the whole state next year. He's doing great. Monitoring heart rate variability and other indicators of overtraining have been a big help. I'm a scientist. I understand the data, but your podcast is the only one that really put it together in a way that's helpful for high school and college kids. My son really embraced your whole approach. He's careful about diet, doesn't eat any processed foods like the bars that other young runners are so popular with. No sugar, no seed oils, no things that are hard to pronounce. Our family spends time on the weekend making healthy food for the week. This young runner is fanatical about his sleep. And when he does big miles in the summer, he sleeps 10 to 10 and a half hours a night with a 1 hour nap in the afternoon. And boy, what an important point to emphasize, especially for young athletes who have an increased need for sleep anyway. Oh my gosh, what better return on investment to improve as an athlete, but to dedicate more time to sleep. And probably the biggest mistake you can make as a young athlete is to skimp on sleep and go out there with your big motor and your big competitive intensity and try to push it. And I contend that my disastrous collegiate running career was strongly influenced by the inability to get adequate sleep when I was living in the dorm facilities where most everyone stayed up until 2 a.m. And then I was up at 8 a.m. while everybody was dead to the world to go do my first workout of the day, and we're often running twice a day. It just didn't work out for me. I got sick. I got injured. I got sick again. I got injured again. I got injured another time. And that was essentially the various seasons of my collegiate running career until I recalibrated things. Turned to the sport of triathlon, got into a better living situation where I could sleep my ass off, just like the North Carolina state champion. And as I relate frequently on the podcast, during my career on the professional circuit of triathlon that I raced from between ages 20 and 30, I was literally asleep for half of my career because I routinely got 10 hours of sleep every night, and I'd take a two-hour nap virtually every afternoon unless I was hindered by traveling or something, and then I would feel it at my evening workout. So I really needed that nap. Sometimes it was hard to wake up from the nap, even having slept 10 hours the previous evening. I was constantly battling to get enough sleep to rest and recover and perform to my capability. So sleep was central to that. And when I described that pattern of 10 hours a night and two-hour nap, that's in season. But what happened at the end of these long competitive seasons where I was traveling on airplanes across the world and logging up huge miles on Pan Am, my favorite airline, and I obtained a Premier Emeritus status where I could go into the private lounges with all the other frequent flyers. So you can guess who those people were. Yes, they had suits and ties and were very prim and proper. And I'd go in there in my sweats and do leg swings and squats and stretches and things in front of these people. Like, how did this guy sneak in here? Well, I put on a lot of miles following the triathlon circuit around the globe. And when those seasons were over, I was exhausted, and it took me a couple months just to recalibrate back to baseline human function, even though I was training very little and just having fun exercising. But I would routinely sleep 12 hours a night for 4, 6, or 8 weeks after the season ended in an attempt to recover. And honestly, the only reason that I would get up is because I felt like a slacker at 10:30 a.m. and I made myself get out of bed, having gone to bed the previous night at 10:30 p.m. So great to hear that certain young runners mention, notably the state champion, is getting his proper sleep. So if you want to be state champion or be up there at the high standard, boy, oh boy, get your sleep handled. Back to the lengthy report from Charles over there in North Carolina. We got a TX bar. We have a hex deadlift bar at the neighbors. He's been working on strength training. Most importantly, he's developed the courage to adjust his training based on how he's feeling. And kudos there, because it's really tough for young runners to do that in a team environment because there's so much misplaced and competitive intensity and questionable coaching methods where all the kids are asked to complete the same workout pattern rather than individualizing everything based on their capability and their recovery rates. I can't overstate the importance of other endurance athletes saying that it's okay to change things up when you're feeling off. For example, if the high school team is doing hills and he has a twinge in his calf or isn't feeling it, he will adjust his workout and absorb that negative feedback from the coach. Hopefully the coach will get his head straight if he's got a state champion on his roster and the state champion decides to bow out early from a workout. You know there's something going on there, and I think the coach should support that. In any case, to finish up the story, Charles's son was the only athlete on his team who didn't have an injury and was able to put in PRs on race day rather than coming in tired and worn out. And that's so common among the youth running programs across our great land and probably across the world, where the kids are simply pushed too hard. They're pushed indiscriminately and in a group manner rather than individualizing the training, and they just bomb out. And it breaks my heart, and it's super frustrating because this was the stuff that was going on when I was in high school 39 years ago, something like that. No, is it 40? Oh my goodness, 41 years ago. And you know, it was tragic. I was very devastated in college when my seasons came to an abrupt end and my career came to an abrupt end because I couldn't keep up with the pace that was established by the pack at large rather than someone looking out for my individual needs. And to realize that it still goes on today is absolutely ridiculous when we have so much knowledge and exchange of information. So I know there's great coaches out there doing great things, but I'll even relate to a member of my extended family who eagerly signed up for the cross-country running team in high school and lasted one season because the program was so intense because they had a varsity team that was contending for the state title. And oh boy, isn't that exciting for those 5, 6, or 7 girls on varsity who've been training for years and years for this wonderful opportunity to excel as seniors. But when you bring a new freshman onto that program, you have to make allowances so that they don't have to set their alarm at 7:30 every single freaking morning in the summertime instead of enjoying a normal summer and a graceful easing into the endurance athletic experience, such that they might even feel like hanging around for more than one and done, which happens so frequently in high school distance running. And I contend I don't give a crap how well the team does it at the state championships. I want to look at the attrition rate that are that exists in under a coach's program and judge the coach largely by that. And I don't think any of that is happening. And we're just too fixated on the excelling of the stars, especially in youth sports, and not enough concerned with those kids that are on the borderline, and who knows what they're bringing to the table. You know, you see the tip of the iceberg when some kid shows up at practice. Maybe there's a dysfunction in the home family. Maybe there's personal issues that they're trying to work through. And boy, you got me started, but I want kids to have a positive personal growth experience rather than get beat up by the regimentation and the competitive intensity of youth sports, high school sports. Okay. Besides that, I have no strong opinions on the subject. Next is Colin. He says, I'm a longtime listener of your podcasts and audiobooks, going back to Primal Endurance, Primal Blueprint. Love the BRAD podcasts and the Primal Endurance podcast. As a longtime fan, I've come to a breakthrough conclusions on this topic of energy balance and stress optimization. I believe that we have an unreasonable desire to count calories as if there is some magic number that we each need every day. Yet it's practically impossible to measure and maintain this caloric intake or actually realize what happens in the body, I'm adding, because of our hormones. And like you say, if we happen to figure it out, calorie restriction might only work for a short time until it doesn't anymore. So can't we all just agree that maintaining a healthy weight really has little to do with how many calories we eat and almost exclusively how good, how quality the food is? Not the taste of it, but the nutrient density and how it affects us physiologically. By subtracting junk food and focusing on food that nourishes the body, that health will return naturally. And that is beautifully said, Colin. And I direct you to my numerous podcasts with Jay Feldman that were published on the BRAD channel, where he talks about this energy balance model and made some really provocative insights where if we consume processed foods, we screw up our body's ability to manufacture energy internally. One particular graphic example is the ingestion of refined industrial seed oils, rendering our fat metabolism dysfunctional and promoting insulin resistance and diabetes. And emerging research is showing this very clearly. Dr. Kate Shanahan has promoted this issue extensively in recent years. And she was also a guest on the BRAD podcast. You can listen to those episodes. But when you consume processed foods, you start to compromise your ability to burn energy. And then guess what you're reliant upon? That's right, more nutrient deficient processed foods. So whatever the calorie count of a Twinkie versus a steak, it has a dramatically different impact on the body and an impact on your metabolism and your body composition. Look no further than the accumulation of visceral fat, also known as belly fat or abdominal fat, over the years. Now, visceral fat is a different kind of fat than general routine stored body fat or subcutaneous fat that's stored, deposited in whatever areas of the body that you have a tendency to. The visceral fat accumulates around the abdominal organs and is extremely health compromising. It's classified as a different organ because it secretes an agent into the bloodstream, inflammatory cytokines that influence, adversely affect metabolism and adversely affect hormonal function, especially sex hormone function. And this visceral fat accumulates due to adverse lifestyle practices, especially the ingestion of processed foods that we have difficulty digesting and assimilating, and wreaks havoc throughout the body on assorted organ and metabolic function. So if you carry a spare tire, even a little spare tire, it begets the accumulation of a bigger spare tire as the years go by. And this is such a routine aspect of aging that we come to view it as normal, but it's largely driven by consuming toxic foods. So forget about the calories. Just like Colin describes here, if you nourish yourself with highest quality foods, you're going to develop, you're going to optimize your natural appetite and satiety mechanisms. You're going to eat the exact amount you need to thrive. And if you have excess body fat to lose, especially visceral fat, that fat will melt off your body like the commercials promise when you are consuming nutritious foods and avoiding the foods that destroy healthy metabolic function. So forget about counting the calories. It's like count the quality. Okay. And here's more from Colin. I work at the Y as a trainer and triathlon coach, and I see this all the time. I'm a former age group triathlete, and I trashed my own metabolism and gained around 60 pounds after completing my last Ironman in 2017. I haven't been able to race. I'm trying to get my health back and get rid of that spare tire that inflated, especially during the pandemic. My condition is causing me to lose clients, but who can blame them for not understanding how a fat guy like myself could be teaching people how to slim down? Maybe I should try the Primal Blueprint 21-Day Total Body Transformation again. And that is the title of a great online course that I have at bradkearns.com. So please check that out, and you get a comprehensive series of videos and written assignments focused in this 21-day boot camp, if you will, to help you correct these drastic problems, such as the metabolic dysfunction caused by ingesting crappy foods. And I really give Colin a lot of credit for writing in and admitting, as he's providing constructive feedback for all of us, that he succumbed to the trashing of his metabolism and gaining excess body fat and gaining a spare tire, spinning out from his time as an Ironman triathlete. And I don't know this, but we could perhaps speculate that the extreme training required to perform an Ironman sometimes causes some fallout because it's too hard to sustain. And when something is unsustainable, your body has a way of recalibrating. Look no further than the Biggest Loser contestants, where follow-up research reveals that almost all of them have gained back all the weight, and in many cases, more weight than they showed up on set with. And these were the people that were weighing 300, 400, 500 pounds, lost huge amounts of weight in a short time, enticed by the incentives provided by the show. But over the long run, they still had signs of metabolic dysfunction driven by the extreme suffering that they endured during the very short duration of the show. So when your body is deprived of calories and driven to excess exercise, it is going to recalibrate for years and years by triggering an excess appetite, especially for nutrient-deficient processed foods, because you've trashed your metabolism so bad with extreme exercise. Okay, so Colin, continuing. I think you hit the nail on the head, Brad, when you said too many good stressors is also stressful, and that stress can delay your efforts to lose excess body fat. So maybe that's what I need, is to get healthy first, then lose weight as a result of getting healthy. I'm interjecting here. Dr. Tommy Woods said this so beautifully in our shows, and you can see a recent rebroadcast of one of the older shows on the BRAD podcast, where he said with his clients, the first objective before trying to drop excess body fat is to get healthy, because you simply will not succeed long-term with dropping excess body fat until you get a healthy metabolism going. And in Colin's case, he says, I do it all: intermittent fasting, cold shower, sauna, early mornings at the gym, low carb diet, HIIT workouts, Orange Theory, and I do have a guilty pleasure of junk food. And cravings are hard to control when you're starving. So maybe, like he speculated, that's a little bit too many stress factors going into the mix when you're talking about the fasting, the showers, the HIIT workouts, early mornings at the gym, so possibly not enough sleep, the low-carb diet. Instead, I would strongly encourage him to slow things down, back off, start walking more, because walking is a great way to enhance your metabolic function without the stress of doing higher heart rate jogging or running. And when you're unhealthy and overfat, especially visceral fat, walking becomes centerpiece, because it will help you optimize those appetite and satiety hormones that have run amok for the various cases, including too much overly stressful chronic cardio exercise patterns. Okay, Brad, that's enough. But you've been a big inspiration to me, training for my big races and becoming a fitness professional. And I enjoyed the Primal Endurance Mastery course as well. You can see all about that at primalendurance.fit. It's still the most comprehensive course on endurance training and racing ever developed. And I would love for you to enroll in that if you haven't already. Primalendurance.fit. And there's a free mini course there where you can see what the major course is all about and why you're making this wonderful investment in the Primal Endurance Mastery course. And for listening to this show, I want to give you a special discount coupon to give you 15% off that course. So please email podcast@bradventures.com and I will give you the code so you can go enroll in the Primal Endurance Mastery course for a discount.
Greetings, my fitness-minded listeners. I want to acquaint you with the Primal Fitness Expert Certification Program, the most comprehensive home study multimedia fitness education course in the world. If you want to enhance your personal knowledge of all aspects of leading a healthy, active, fit lifestyle, this total immersion course will be life-changing. I'm the lead instructor and author of the course, and we have 14 chapters of extensive written content with over 100 accompanying videos covering topics such as general everyday movement, including micro workouts and dynamic workstation tips, the full experience of gym-based strength training and all the different modalities, a complete presentation on all aspects of sprinting, both running and low impact options, an assortment of high intensity interval training and high intensity repeat training strategies, a detailed education on the principles and practical application of aerobic endurance training, and extensive commentary, the most you will find in any publication, on all aspects and symptoms of overtraining and burnout. We even have fascinating peripheral topics like integrating nasal diaphragmatic breathing, dynamic stretching, injury prevention, and developing a peak performance mindset. It's really something, this course. We went all out for over 2 years with a great team to develop this amazing home-based fitness education for you. And you get one-on-one expert email support and private Facebook group connection throughout your studies to ensure that you absorb everything optimally and you pass your series of exams and get certified. So go to primalhealthcoach.com/Brad to enjoy a very special limited time. And I'm not kidding. This is a big time discount just for you. 25% off your tuition. A fantastic premium offer at primalhealthcoach.com/Brad for the most comprehensive fitness course you can ever find.
Here comes Debbie. I'm a 65 years young female in very good shape. I've run and jogged for 50 years. No injuries, no problems. I run 6 miles every day and road bike 15 miles every day. Since I incorporated sprinting, it is more difficult to feel good on my run. I think it may be from fatigue. And secondly, can you please direct your podcasts and YouTube videos toward older females? There are not many that do this, and I think you may have a nice following after a while. It seems we've been left out in many areas. So Debbie, first things, if you're running 6 miles a day and road biking 15 miles a day, that's a huge commitment to endurance training. It requires a lot of energy, and I'm desperately hoping that your heart rate is predominantly at or below fat max during these daily workouts. In most cases, and most enthusiastic exercisers, even those with a lot of experience like you, a lot of that time is above fat max heart rate. And so you are technically immersed in a chronic cardio exercise pattern if this daily routine includes drifting above fat max. With that kind of volume, almost all those workouts should be at or below fat max. And then when you incorporate sprinting, you'll be much better off to absorb and benefit from the different fitness stimulation that a sprint workout provides without getting tired. But sprinkling in sprinting to your schedule and noticing more fatigue and feeling crappy during those endurance sessions is a reliable indicator that overall you have now tipped out of balance with the overall stress level of your workout pattern. So I would say, first off, maybe put sprinting on hold for a while you recalibrate and devotedly keep your heart rate at or below fat max during both your daily run and your daily bike ride. And you didn't provide more details, so maybe we're going to assume that you do this 7 days a week, run 6 miles and bike 15 miles, or even if it's 5 days a week or something close to that, that's a huge commitment to a very narrow sliver of what builds overall fitness competency. So I would also strongly encourage you to mix things up a bit. And sure, you love to do that little pattern of run, then bike. Do it 2, 3, 4 days a week. Perhaps take some days where you're not exercising for that long a duration and instead just going out for a short walk or something that obviously you like exercise to be the centerpiece of your day. And then allocate time over time as you start to feel better to doing high intensity strength training, of course, as well as brief explosive all out sprints. And if you're not mentioning resistance exercise in your little message here, that would be a huge priority as a 65-year-old female, because we see a huge incidence of sarcopenia. That's the age-related loss of muscle mass, especially among females. And it's driven by their general distaste for doing resistance exercise in comparison to males. And then secondly, their general neglect of dietary protein. Again, making generalizations about the female population. So not to offend anybody, but the females who are having their morning smoothies and noontime salads and staying away from things like steak and red meat and a lot of eggs and stuff like that. And then they're also staying away from the bros in the gym and instead just trotting down the road for 6 miles of running and 15 miles of biking every day. That's an easy way to accelerate the loss of muscle mass. And we don't want that. We want you to be an all-around fitness specimen at age 65, especially with that impressive dedication to your workouts. So put the bike down for a bit, put the running shoes aside, and get into the gym and start putting your muscles under resistance load to build and or maintain that lean muscle mass in the years ahead. And concurrently in the diet, please make a concerted effort to increase your daily protein intake to around or above 1 gram per pound of body weight. And that is a lot if you're eating, in a typical healthy pattern, especially if you're plant-based or doing anything silly like that. Excuse me, did I just say that? Anyway, you got to get the protein in as your top priority, especially with that training volume. Please take a look at the BRAD Whey Protein Plus Creatine Super Fuel. You can find it on Amazon. You can find it at bradnutrition.com. And this is a great way to easily just take a scoop, mix it in water, and you will bump up your daily protein intake gracefully without having to overhaul your diet or slave over the stove every morning making scrambled eggs if that's not your current pattern. How does that sound? Okay, Billy B. Aloha, Brad. Happy to hear the Primal Endurance podcast coming back after that lull. It's great for all of us to hear healthy habits reinforced over and over. I came across the writings of people like Arthur Lydiard, Phil Maffetone while studying exercise physiology 20 years ago. I related with their principles way more than what my professors were talking about and almost got kicked out of university for calling a professor a damn fool. Okay, man. Good for you, man. Speak up. We got to change academia one little comment at a time. Anyway, at 38, he recently set a marathon PR while working full-time and having a one-year-old. all without sacrificing health for fitness. I know the phrase, listen to your body, and I appreciate your emphasis on that. I found that most friends and people I know get stuck in an injury cycle, and they're numbers driven, and they have no idea how to listen to their body. So maybe a show where you could break down some markers scientifically would reach some of these people and help them understand it's helpful to rest and slow down. Well, I think the endurance culture has done a good job of that in recent years, because now there's so much technology available, from the biofeedback devices that measure training, like heart rate, like wattage output, and the biohacking tools, like the sleep trackers and the heart rate variability tracker. And all that stuff's wonderful. But again, if you are numbers driven and have difficulty listening to your body, it's very possible that you can get too deep into the numbers game at the expense of just using simple common sense. So I will definitely put in a plug here for go ahead and measure everything if you want. But we do have to put a huge vote in for an intuitive approach to training. And what that mostly looks like, practically speaking, is a willingness and an ability to adjust your workout decisions and your training schedule on the fly. And believe me, it took me many years to learn this the hard way when I was competing as a professional on the triathlon circuit, that I wanted to accomplish a certain amount of weekly mileage in each sport. I wanted to hit the major workouts like the Tuesday morning anaerobic threshold run and the long bike ride on Wednesday or Saturday, and all the things that we had in store every week and were so eager and excited and ready to jump into. But when I felt a little bit off at some of these workouts, I realized that if I carried on bullheadedly to complete my weekly schedule, and a lot of recreational athletes are paying good money for these schedules from prominent coaches, without that intuitive component in there, if I carried on and finished up my weekly mileage as intended, I would go and get my butt kicked on the race course. When I developed the strength and the ability to listen to my body and respect it and take action and exert some of that discipline that we often celebrate of how disciplined a triathlete is to get out there and train every day and do all those workouts, I had to exert that discipline in the opposite direction. That is, to exert the discipline to stay home and sit on the couch while my buddies were going out for a 100-mile bike ride because I just wasn't feeling right. That's when things turned around for me and I broke through to a higher level on the race course. This was particularly associated with my move from Los Angeles to a small town in Northern California, where I, in the middle of my career, this occurred, and I immediately went from training in these huge groups and huge packs and swim team workouts and giant packs of cyclists and groups of runners. There was always someone eager and willing to push the pace, to doing the vast majority of my training alone or with much slower training partners, because that's all that was available around. And that's when I had my two best breakthrough seasons, because I finally gave my body a break from the constant pounding and competitiveness of the concentrated training environment and the many people around, to being forced to listen to my body because I was the only one out there, the only heart beating. And so, you know, I would slow down to the proper pace accordingly. All right. So Barry is going to talk about Peter Attia's new book, Outlive. And I want your opinion on a couple things that Attia brings up, Barry says. Number one, the chapter on heart disease. He's adamant about lowering markers like ApoB and LDL-C using statins and other cholesterol-lowering drugs. And number two, for cardio, he states more is better in the zone two range, but isn't that chronic cardio? So what I'm answering to Barry is, first, yes, I've heard Dr. Attia talk about drug intervention on his podcast, and I think when he is dealing with someone with serious genetic risk factors, like Peter reports in his own family, that's when you're inclined to zero in on that stuff with precision medicine and highly qualified practitioners, such as Peter treating his patients, right? But when you're talking about mainstream medicine, that's a huge diversion from the elite precision medicine that Peter practices and dispenses to his own clients. So my philosophy is, I don't want to take anything unless absolutely necessary. And if someone tells me it's absolutely necessary, I want to get a second and a third and a fourth opinion. And that's my personal message. I encourage you, all of you listening, watching, to do the same. So if you're, even if it's a long-time trusted family physician says, yeah, I'm going to start you on a statin, you know what? I would turn you over to Peter Attia's great podcast, The Drive, or his number one best-selling book, and educate yourself on the use of statins to treat heart disease risk and all the nuances that there are there, rather than just swallowing a pill and thinking that there's any prescription drug that does not have a direct consequence, a side effect, or a price to pay. And this is a tough one to get through a lot of people's heads, because we've been so socialized to think that a pill is going to be the solution to our problems, or an injection or a surgery or whatever medical intervention there is. Now, there's going to be some things that are highly effective to deal with your condition. However, when it's talking about a prescription drug, there is a price to pay in terms of managing homeostasis on your own. That's just a general take on the use of pharmaceutical intervention. And I'm also not blind to the many wonderful advancements in modern medicine and precision medicine. I'm a huge enthusiast of all these things. I've talked a lot on the BRAD podcast about the subject of testosterone replacement therapy. And again, I'm adhering to my lifelong protocol of not taking anything unless absolutely necessary, and doing everything you can to intervene naturally with healthy lifestyle practices. But we're going to keep checking back on the subject every 5 years, because someday, if there is validation that my life can be enhanced, my quality of life can be enhanced through drug intervention that can delay the aging process gracefully with less adverse side effects than the benefits, of course I'm going to be open to that. But I think we jump to easy pain relief. I just heard a podcast recently where they're talking about the simple example. Oh, no, excuse me. It was Morgan Housel's The Psychology of Money, wonderful book. But he was talking a brief insight about how when a human experiences a fever, we immediately rush to take a fever lowering medication. When in fact, a mild fever, of course, I'm not talking about an extreme fever requiring hospitalization, but a mild fever is the body's way of dealing with an infection. Or an offense of some kind that the body's going to cook out and make you feel better. So taking fever-lowering medication, my policy extends to that too. If I have a fever, I'm going to go into a dark room, go under the covers and sleep it off and feel like crap and allow my body to work, rather than mask these symptoms and prolong the severity of the illness. Morgan Housel was talking about it in the context of a correction in the stock market. And as soon as we see some bad news, investors panic and sell rather than seeing a correction in the same manner as a fever. It's a beautiful analogy there. And then the second question came from Barry about zone two. So in my interpretation, zone two is associated with fat max heart rate or MAF heart rate. And so zone one, which is easy exercise like walking or hiking, and zone two, which would be a proper cardiovascular training session where you limit your heart rate to fat max or below, is going to deliver outstanding benefits without that risk of chronic cardio that comes when you routinely drift even slightly above your zone two limit and start to burn fewer fat calories and an increasing amount of glucose calories, also producing stress hormones, also possibly causing acid accumulation in the muscles if you're getting up toward anaerobic threshold, and greatly extending your recovery time from a true zone two session, which emphasizes fat burning. At the fat max is the term for the point where you're burning the maximum number of fat calories per minute with a minimal amount of anaerobic stimulation. And if you were to increase beyond fat max or beyond the limit of zone two, you would start to burn more glucose calories and fewer fat calories. So It's great to see the popularity of Zone 2 and those who are promoting it aggressively, but I also think it's a little gimmicky. And since I predate the zone, since my endurance career goes back to when we just tried to, build our fat-burning engines by taking it easy, I also want to put in a wonderful plug for Zone 1 exercise because you get a tremendous aerobic conditioning benefit from exercising comfortably. Well below your fat max heart rate at zone one. And so we never hear about zone one. We just hear about zone two is great, zone two for longevity, zone two for this, zone two for that. So let's talk about zone one and zone two and doing the vast majority of your steady state cardiovascular exercise at comfortable heart rates. And again, when I was racing at the highest level, I did a ton of weekly volume at heart rates significantly below my fat max heart rate. I'm talking 20, 30, 40, sometimes 50 beats below my fat max. So that would be an easy pedaling on flat ground of 15, 16, 17 miles an hour. For example, the day before a race or the day after a race, where my heart rate would be 105, whereby my fat max was 155. And at that pace, I could maintain a speed of 23, 24 miles an hour as a fit triathlete. So there's tremendous training benefits to be had, training way, way, way below fat max. But it seems like the average recreational enthusiast is obsessed with pegging their heart rate right at that zone two limit, thinking that's where they need to be. True, the maximum aerobic conditioning stimulation is going to be at that fat max heart rate, but we can't do that day after day. And I also cite the example of the greatest marathon runner, one of the greatest endurance athletes ever on the planet, Eliud Kipchoge, and they did a detailed analysis of his training. You can find that online and also in the upcoming book that Mark Sisson and I are working on called Born to Walk. But he does somewhere around 80% of his weekly mileage at what the average recreational participant would call zone one. He's running 6:30 to 8 minute pace per mile for most of his running. Yes, he does some pretty badass interval workouts and six times 1,000 meters at 2 minutes, 50 seconds or whatever. When they go hard, these guys go hard. But for the most part, he is out there, quote unquote, jogging. And he is the greatest marathoner of all time with tremendous fitness capability and capacity to work much harder than the average person. And yet, the average marathon runner works much harder than Kipchoge, relatively speaking. That is just a slap in the face, mind-blowing insight. And if that doesn't get you to slow down and dedicate yourself to more walking and less running right at fat max, or God forbid, above fat max, I do not know what will. This is how you build the body without the interruption of breakdown, burnout, illness, and injury that comes from routinely pushing your body a little bit too hard. So I talk about Kipchoge's pace of 6:30 to 8 minutes per mile for most of his training. And you might be listening going, well, that's pretty fast. 6:30s, that's moving. And 8 minutes is not too shabby either. But remember, this man's pace per mile in the marathon is 4:34, 4 minutes and 34 seconds per mile when he set the record, famously dipping under 2 hours with his 159 marathon. Not in an official competition, so it's not called the world record. But anyway, the guy's a 2 hour marathoner running 4:34 per mile. So he is running. I did the calculation in the book. It's like 43 to 68% slower than his marathon pace. 4:30 mile in the marathon, 6:30 mile in training. So why don't you take 2 minutes off of your marathon pace, or perhaps even more, because again, we're going by percentage. So I'm going to ask you to take, let's say, a 3 to 4 minutes off of your marathon pace so that you may honor the wonderful example set by Kipchoge for how to build the aerobic system without interruption from breakdown burnout. And tell me what that pace per mile is. And realize that exercise physiology gait analysis reveals that the average human switches from walking to jogging at a 14 minute per mile pace. So anything slower than 14 minutes a mile, is requiring of a walk, and that would be a great training effect for you if you're a 4-hour marathoner. Excuse me, 4:30 is the average marathon finishing time among 2 million marathon finishers every year, and that is a 10:18 per mile. So if you add 3 or 4 minutes to that, you are talking about walking being an appropriate and highly effective training session for the average marathoner. Besides that, go knock yourself out and run really fast a lot, right? That's a great way to get yourself into that hole of breakdown, burnout, illness, and injury. So sure, zone two is great. That's when you're going right up near your marathon race pace. In fact, a marathon race pace is actually 15 seconds faster than your fat max pace per mile. But for the most part, don't forget to put a huge chunk of your training in at comfortable zone one heart rates, even if you harbor really ambitious competitive goals, because that's what the very best in the world do, and it will work for you too. Thank you for watching, listening, and send your questions to podcast@bradventures.com and specify there for the Primal Endurance Podcast so we can categorize it and do another show soon. I look forward to hearing from your feedback. Thank you so much.
I'm so excited to introduce you to Paluva. This is a new zero-drop minimalist shoe with the distinctive five-toe design from my main man, Mark Sisson. Paluvas give you the most authentic barefoot-style experience, but with sufficient cushioning so you can use them for all manner of daily movement, especially walking and many other fitness and athletic activities. Paluvas are also incredibly stylish, so you get a barefoot shoe that you're not embarrassed to wear around in daily life. It's been so cool to see the popularity of minimalist shoes grow over the recent years, but Paluvas are a step ahead of every other zero-drop wide-box shoe because of the critical feature of individual five-toe articulation, a separate slot for each of your toes. This allows for correct dynamic movement of the foot through the walking or running stride, which is impossible when your toes are encased into a single box, even a wide box. Well, you might know that minimalist shoes have faced controversy in recent years for causing injuries from inappropriate use. So here is the big picture mission. We want to get you walking in Paluvas, living in your Paluvas, going barefoot in your home or other safe areas as often as possible. Go ahead and use your specialized cushiony running shoes or your basketball shoes, work boots, high heels, things that you want to wear when you want to wear them, but wear your Paluvas as much as possible to reawaken the natural functionality of the human foot to stand, walk, run, and perform. Do you want to try a pair? I'm certain that when you put them on and walk around, you are going to quickly realize that these are the most comfortable natural shoes that you've ever worn. They are designed to feel like you're, quote, walking barefoot on a putting green. Please visit Paluva.com, that's P-E-L-U-V-A, and use the code BRADPODCAST and get 10% off your first pair. Paluvas, let your feet be feet. I hope you enjoyed this episode and encourage you to check out the Primal Endurance Mastery Course at primalendurance.fit. This is the ultimate online educational experience where you can learn from the world's great coaches and trainers, diet, peak performance, and recovery experts, as well as lengthy one-on-one interviews from several of the greatest endurance athletes of all time, not published anywhere else. It's a major educational experience with hundreds of videos, but you can get free access to a mini course with an ebook summary of the Primal Endurance Approach and 9 step-by-step videos on how to become a Primal Endurance Athlete. This mini course will help you develop a strong basic understanding of this all-encompassing approach to endurance training that includes primal aligned eating to escape carbohydrate dependency and enhance fat metabolism, building an aerobic base with comfortably paced workouts, strategically introducing high-intensity strength and sprint workouts, emphasizing rest recovery and annual periodization, and finally cultivating an intuitive approach to training instead of the usual robotic approach of fixed weekly workout schedules. Just head over to primalendurance.fit and learn all about the course and how we can help you go faster and preserve your health while you're at it.